What I'm going to talk about tonight is the second book in this series. Second book in this series, which is a detailed analysis of the constitutional question that this book builds upon. The constitutional militia, interpreting the Constitution, interpreting the militia within the Constitution. Now, the first question that comes to mind is, who cares? Why is this subject important? Sounds anachronistic at best, right? Well, if you go to the Second Amendment, and I start there simply because of the language, because actually the militia is mentioned in the body of the original Constitution. You go to the Second Amendment, it reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We're probably all familiar with that, at least with the operative phrase, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But notice the phrase that precedes it, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Well, what could be more vital than that? The security of a free state, and not just any state, but a free state. And nothing other than a well-regulated militia is said to be necessary for that purpose. In fact, if you read through the Constitution, you will see that the Founding Fathers never identified anything else as necessary for any purpose. The Constitution doesn't say Congress is necessary. It doesn't say the President is necessary. It doesn't say the Supreme Court is necessary. The only thing it says is necessary for any purpose is a well-regulated militia. So apparently they were taking that subject rather seriously. All right, well, what is it? Again, we come to that conundrum. What do the words mean, right? The definition of is. What does is mean? We've heard about that before. What is a well-regulated militia? What is the right of the people to keep and bear arms? Well, that brings us to the methodological question. How do we go about finding out? Well, if you go to the Constitution, some words and phrases are, in fact, defined. Congress is defined. The House of Representatives. The Senate are defined. Why? Because these were new institutions that had not existed previously. If they hadn't defined them, no one would have known what they were talking about. Treason is another good example. Treason is very specifically defined. Why? Because the English law of treason was rather compendious. There were all sorts of behaviors that could have been considered treasonous. And the Founding Fathers wanted to cut that down to a very narrow and specific kind of behavior. Right? Waging war against the United States, giving aid and comfort to the enemy. So that's why that definition is found. But if you look at many, many extremely important words and phrases, you will find no definition. Jury, trial by jury, not defined. Writ of habeas corpus, not defined. Felony, not defined. War, not defined. Legislature, not defined. Republican form of government, not defined. State and states, never defined. Freedom of speech, right of the people peaceably to assemble, and so forth and so on from the First Amendment. None of it's defined. So, of course, when we come to the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia, or if we look back at the body of the original Constitution, where it refers to the militia of the several states, or if we look at the right of the people to keep and bear arms, we find none of them defined either. Well, I don't think that was accidental, and I don't think it was the result of negligence on the part of the Founding Fathers. I think it reflected their belief, and the belief of probably everyone else that was literate enough to read the Constitution, that every linguistically and historically and legally literate American then, and one would hope thereafter, would know what all those terms meant and would continue to apply those definitions in the future. And you really have to ask yourself, would the Founding Fathers have considered something that they believed was necessary to the security of a free state to be undefinable or undefined? Would they have left that undefined? Would they have left that to ever-changing definitions by Congress or the states or the various court systems as political expedience demanded? Well, I should think not. And there's a quotation from one Supreme Court opinion that makes a certain amount of sense, West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, 1943. The very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles. One's fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections. No elections for public office, no elections, votes within Congress, no elections or votes within the court system. They depend on the outcome of no elections. Well, of course, that depends upon their having a definition that we all know. So the founders' use of these critically important terms, necessary, security, and free, in connection with the militia, tells us that those phrases, well-regulated militia, right of the people to keep and bear arms, were sufficiently defined, at least to them, to satisfy who? We the people, the three most important words in the Constitution. Right? We the people. Not within the Constitution itself, because they were trying to be succinct, but by some kind of legal and historical experience that at that point was common to all Americans, or at least to most of them. So where outside of the Constitution do we find the correct definitions of the terms of well-regulated militia and the right of the people to keep and bear arms? Well, you often see constitutionalists, usually, developing compendia of the statements of the Founding Fathers. You see these little books that will have all the statements of the Founding Fathers. I've seen them about the Second Amendment and various other provisions of the Constitution. And we learn what James Madison said, what Jefferson said, what George Mason said, even what Alexander Hamilton may have said. Now, these statements are, of course, facts in the sense that they were made. They did, as it were, happen. That's what they wrote. That's what they said. But when you think about it in the way lawyers think about these things, you realize that those statements are pretty much no more than the opinions of those men who made them. They are not necessarily historical or legal facts in the sense that they are accurate or true. Even if some particular framer or founder could in some sense be considered an expert on the subject, if he were in a court today, his testimony would not necessarily be conclusive evidence. He could have been intentionally misstating the matter, perhaps to make a point in political debates. And if you read the debates in the state conventions, you see a lot of that back and forth. Political hyperbole. He could have been biased. Maybe Hamilton comes to mind when you think of that possibility. He could have been honestly wrong. He could have been confused. In a court of law today, an expert may testify about his opinion on a matter within an area of expertise, but then he is always subject to cross-examination on the basis of the source of that opinion and the sufficiency of the opinion. And a jury can discount his testimony entirely if it determines that the basis of the opinion or the reasoning that's involved in getting to it is somehow faulty, or if he's biased or prejudiced or has some other personal disqualification. So what we really have to do is look at or question, ask ourselves, what was the objective basis for these opinions of the Founding Fathers concerning the militia and the right to keep and bear arms, which we see so often quoted? Well, the basis had to be their personal experience and their knowledge of pre-constitutional history, because they weren't talking about theory. These happened to be probably the most practical political philosophers in the history of Western civilization, or at least high up on that level. So we have to conclude that the best evidence is not their personal opinions on what the militia were and how they functioned, or what the right of the people to keep and bear arms may have entailed, but instead that actual pre-constitutional colonial and state experience that they had. And where is that found? It's interesting that in this case, it's found in literally hundreds of statutes from the 1600s to the late 1700s in each one of the 13 colonies and then independent states. Statutes which specified what was supposed to be done with respect to the militia, what were the standards that governed when, how, and by whom it should be done, and all details. These laws are the ultimate objective and impersonal evidence. They validate the framers' opinions, not the other way around. Obviously, the framers were basing their opinion on these laws. And these laws tell us what the Constitution means. Why? Because the Constitution incorporates and adopts these structures called the militia of the several states, which pre-existed the Constitution. They are not created by the Constitution. They are adopted and incorporated by the Constitution. And their existence was determined by these colonial and state statutes for approximately 150 years. From, I guess, the first one in being in Massachusetts in the early 1630s. And they were still passing these laws even after the peace treaty was signed, the War of Independence. Now, what's interesting about these laws, and some of us have taken the time to read every one of them. I won't take your time tonight, but if you're really interested in this, you can go and find online a microfiche set, copy of a book that was put out by the Selective Service System. Actually, I cite it in here, which contains 14 volumes. One is an overview, and then there were 13 volumes that contain photostatic copies of large excerpts of statutes from each one of the colonies from the beginning, as early as they could find them, up until approximately the time of the War of Independence. And the Selective Service was putting these out to show that there had been this tradition of military service going all the way back to the earliest colonial period. So it's there. I have actually gone and into each state and looked up every one of these laws. So I found quite a few more than the Selective Service had found. You folks in Maryland, if you go to the Maryland Archives online, you can pull this stuff out. It takes a little bit of searching, but it's all there. What's interesting, they were all substantively the same. In the sense that if you pull a statute out of Rhode Island, and you pull a statute out of Maryland, and you pull a statute out of Virginia, you pull out of New York, and you cut off the title so you don't know from which state it came, and you sort of shuffle these like a deck of cards and pick it up, you won't know which state it came from. Because the substantive provisions were very, very similar until you get to the slave states, the predominantly slave states, because they were all slave states in those days. Slavery was legal in every one of those colonies. The predominantly slave states, they will all have some provisions dealing with what they call the patrols, which were the duties of the militia to control the plantations and make sure that the slaves were not somehow getting off on their own. These statutes tell us precisely what the militia of the several states were. They tell us what the right of the people to keep and bear arms was. And it's interesting, when you go through them, as I'll point out later, it was really not a right in the sense that we look at it. It was a duty. I have never been able to find a colonial statute that talks about a right to keep and bear arms. Every one of them talks about a duty to keep and bear arms. It's a fascinating distinction. And in terms of these principles that you can draw out of this huge mass, and it is huge, for the colony of Rhode Island alone, I have 90 single-spaced pages in 11-point type. And these are the excerpts that I took. It's a huge amount of material. In terms of these principles, the situation today, 2008, is exactly the same legally as it was in 1788, in 1778, in 1768, in 1758, or back into the 1600s. Those principles never changed during that period. They were adopted by the Founding Fathers in the Constitution, and given that there has been no amendment subsequently, they have never changed. All right, well, what are they? Well, the first thing is that the militia were institutions that were separately established in every colony and independent state. There was no overall British colonial militia. There was the militia of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and so forth, down to Georgia. So that would mean that today there could be no such thing as the militia of the United States. And of course, there isn't. You look in the Constitution, what does it call these things? The militia of the several states. And it uses that terminology, the several states, when it's talking about the states as this collective bunch over here. You'll see that term, the several states, used again and again in the Constitution. Now, secondly, the militia were integral parts of the colonial and state governmental structures with governmental authority. There was never in those days such a thing as private militias that we see sometimes running around here. They didn't exist at all. If you were part of a militia, it was subject to a state statute, and you were part of this governmental institutional structure with governmental authority. And that's a key factor as well, governmental authority. The militia were based on the duty of universal service of all able-bodied free males from 16 to 60 years of age. You have to remember in those days, women were not, quote, emancipated. If a woman was not a spinster or a widow, she was subject legally to her husband or to her father. And they also, according to the social mores of the time, did not believe, and perhaps rightly so, I think we would agree, that women had any place in combat organizations. And the militia, of course, were constantly being called upon for that particular function, whether they were dealing with the Indians or the French or eventually the British and the Indians. Right? Now, I suppose today that concept could be expanded to non-combatant roles for some females. Nurses, for instance, one could imagine. But it's interesting that even in those days, and I'll get to this in the next point, there was a connection between the women and the militia. Now, as I said before, the right to keep and bear arms, which is mentioned in the Second Amendment, was in all of those statutes a duty to keep and bear arms. I would love to have someone present me with a statute from that period that talks about the right to keep and bear arms. I would frame it to show how stupid I was that I couldn't find it myself. I've read this over and over again until my eyes are falling out. That's why I'm wearing these. And I have never found that, ever, a statute dealing with a right to keep and bear arms. It was a duty to keep and bear arms. All of these eligible, able-bodied, free males, and remember, they had slavery then. So in most instances, the slaves or the Indians were not part of the militia structure. Were required to obtain their own firearms and ammunition. From where? From the free market. They were required to buy them themselves. Unless they were too poor. And if they were too poor, then the statutes had various ways to deal with that. They'd get your job. If you were a farmer, they'd try to sell your produce for you. If you were really poor, they'd put up what they called a rate. They'd collect some taxes in the town, and they'd buy you a gun. Or the militia would give you a gun because the militia had collected fines from people who had failed in their militia duties, and they used those fines to buy a gun for the person who was too poor to have one. But the basic principle was everyone possessed his own gun, and where? Not in some government arsenal. He kept it in his own home. And you were fined if you didn't do that. Literally, they would send inspectors around to the homes with lists to see whether you had the firearm, the necessary amount of ammunition, the bayonet, the tomahawk, the sword, whatever was on that list, depending on what type of militia company you were in. If you didn't have it, you were fined. And if you were fined and you couldn't pay, any of your other property was subject to distraint, taken for sale to pay for those guns. So they all had to be armed with their own firearms unless they were too poor. And what that tells you was that they relied on a free market. It had to be a free market, or else where would they have gotten these firearms? Free commerce in arms. Now, these firearms were not what we would today call sporting firearms. They may have been used for sport. They probably would have been used in many instances for hunting. And I can imagine people going out for target practice, because they considered that that was important in terms of learning how to use this firearm. But these were the types of firearms that were used, or at least were usable, by the regular military forces of those days. And it wasn't too difficult, because once the flintlock appeared, it remained the basic long arm, short arm, for that matter, the basic firearm for over 120, 150 years. So they weren't having constant technological turnovers. But the fact was, if you read some of these statutes, you will see technological turnovers. Rhode Island's a good example. It goes from the matchlock to the firelock to the flintlock. As each of these innovations came in, the statutes changed and said, now you've got to have the better thing. And then eventually they get to the point where they allowed rifle guns, as they called them, which was the latest technology. Right? So these were the types of firearms that would have been used by the regular forces, and they certainly would have been used by any kind of irregular force that you could imagine, the typical, what do they call them, guerrilleros, the partisans, the franc tireurs, what have you. And as I said, they had to maintain these firearms in their personal possession, and they had to train on a regular basis. Now, that was usually people between 16 and 50, for the obvious reason that once you got above 50 in those days, well, if you were still alive, you probably weren't capable of doing too much in the field. Although, if you read the accounts of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, it's amazing how many of these people came out and they were then 60s, 70s, and even 80 years old. If they could come out on the porch and shoot at the redcoats, they were doing it. So 16 to 50 was the required training age. 50 to 60, they called the alarm list. You had the same other requirements. You didn't have to show up for training, but if they had an alarm, you had to come out for duty. And to show you how far this went, there was one fellow in Rhode Island who was lame in one leg and blind in one eye, and he wanted to be excused from militia duty. In those days, you had to petition the General Assembly. Everything was done through the General Assembly in Rhode Island. They had a legislative supremacy. And they granted his petition with a caveat and said, yes, you can be excused from regular militia duty except alarms. If we call everybody, you come too, blind in one eye and lame in one leg. So they were serious about that. Firearms and ammunition generally were not seizable for payment of debt or taxes, interestingly enough. They were a very special kind of property. Why? Because it was necessary for the security of the free state that these people have them. Now, the legislature did grant certain statutory exemptions by which certain people were excused from regular duty. And they were exemptions really within the militia, not from the militia. So if you were a public official, member of the legislature, constable, sheriff, judge in the courts, or clerk, and so forth and so on, you were given an exemption from regular training. If you were a physician, a minister, in some places where they had a university or higher education school teacher, if you were a ferryman, you were always exempted. Why? Because the ferry was a key element in the communication system, transportation system. You had to be there. If you were a miller, you were always exempted. Why? Who else was going to grind the grain? So there are some categories of public office or critical private enterprise that were exempted from the regular militia duties of training. These people still had to have a gun, and they still found themselves being called out in alarms. And in fact, in Rhode Island, they formed a special class called the senior class. So you had the alarm class, which was the superannuated folks. You had the, what they called the training bands, which were the 15 to 60 folks that came out on a regular basis to train. And then Rhode Island gave these other folks, the exempted people, a special name called the senior class and described what they had to do. And you also had conscientious objectors. Eventually, all of the colonies recognized conscientious objection for those people who were members of essentially the Quakers, the Mennonites, the other Pacific religions. But it was fascinating to read what they did with them. They said, well, you don't have to come out to training. You don't have to have a firearm. And you don't have to engage in any kind of martial activity. But if we have one of these crises, one of these alarms, you might have to serve in the following ways. You might have to take the women and children to safety. You might have to drive the cattle away from the battlefield. Or you would have to serve as a spy or a scout. Now stop and think about that for a second. Now, the law of war in those days and still today, if you're captured, even a militiaman wearing an armband, so you're identified, you can be held as a prisoner of war, but you can't be shot out of hand. If you're caught as a spy, you can be hanged or shot on the spot. All right, the law of war gives you absolutely no protection. So it's fascinating to see that the conscientious objectors, although they didn't have to go and fight, they could be made to perform a more dangerous duty even than the regular militiamen. So you can see these colonial people were very, very serious about this process. Now, as I said, the Constitution adopts and incorporates the pre-constitutional militia just as they were at the time. And we know that because it didn't define them in some new way. If it wanted to create a new institution, it would have given us a definition of that institution, not simply used the name that was recognized at the time. So what does that tell us? Well, exactly what I said before. The militia are state establishments. The Constitution presumes they'll be in existence as long as the states are, militia of the several states. And also because, as it says, a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. Now, you have to contrast this with another provision of the Constitution that deals with troops. Troops are the standing army of some kind. And the Constitution says no state shall, without the consent of Congress, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace. You cannot have a standing army within any state or a, I guess, sailing navy, floating navy, right? What would be the terminology there? So the militia are different from a standing army. Why? Because the militia are a check and balance on the standing army. All right? That's the real reason. It's not because they might be more efficient than a standing army. It's not because they might be more patriotic than a standing army. It's because they are more trustworthy than a standing army. If you read anything that George Washington ever said about the militia, he didn't give them very high marks for fighting ability. And the Founding Fathers were certainly familiar with that immediate history. And yet they put it in the Constitution anyway, twice, in the body of the Constitution and in the Second Amendment, because they were much more concerned about this other function that needed to be performed, the check and balance against the standing army. It's also interesting that of all of the potential institutions that either the Constitution mentions or perhaps Congress would have the power to create, the only institution that is explicitly given the power to execute the law, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions is what? Is it the Army? No. Is it the Navy? No. Is it the Department of Homeland Security? Well, that doesn't even exist in the Constitution. Right. It's the militia of the several states. The only institution given that authority. Now, I would stop right there for a moment and ask the question, when this 9/11 event caused people in Washington to come to the conclusion that they needed to build up a Homeland Security operation, why didn't they look to the Book of Instructions? Why didn't they look to the Constitution and see what's the only institution or establishment in the Constitution that the Constitution refers to as necessary to the security of the free state and gives these three powers, which are a pretty good synopsis of Homeland Security, execute the law, suppress insurrections, and repel invasion. I mean, what more do you want to add to that as a generality? And, of course, they didn't. And I think they didn't because, as the Constitution points out, the militia are ultimately under state control, not really congressional control. Congress can call out the militia for those three purposes and those three purposes only. Otherwise, the militia remains state institutions. The only officer of the militia who is an officer of the general government is who? President of the United States. The only one. All the other officers in the militia are appointed by whom? The states. Not by the Senate, not by Congress, not by the president. They are state institutions, which is probably one of the reasons why the people in Washington, D.C. didn't think it would be too good an idea to base their homeland security system on the states. Because you wouldn't have centralized control, you'd have control from the bottom up, and they like to think in terms of control from the top down. Now, if we look at the pre-constitutional militia acts, of course, they were statutes. You go back, the philosophical basis of them, because they arise from a higher law of self-preservation of individuals and communities, and the duty of everyone in the community to defend everyone else. You find that in Blackstone, for instance. What happened when they were constitutionalized? All of those principles became constitutional principles, right? Because they were the principles that defined those entities. Well, that brings you to the right to keep and bear arms. Right? The right to keep and bear arms was originally a duty to keep and bear arms. And of course, the other side of that duty is, if I have a right to keep and bear arms because the statute tells me to do it, then nobody can tell me not to do it. I have a right against all of those other people to keep and bear those arms, right? And now if that's brought in as a constitutional principle, all of us who would be part of the militia having this constitutional duty to keep and bear arms, there must be an absolute right to keep and bear arms. If it's a constitutional duty, it's quite obvious the government can have absolutely no power there to tell us not to fulfill that duty. So our friends in Washington and the Solicitor General's office just filed a brief the other day in this Heller case, the D.C. gun case, saying that the position of the administration was that, well, maybe Heller was right, he could have a gun in his house in D.C., but the right to keep and bear arms is subject to reasonable regulation. I just mentioned the reasonable regulations. They're all regulations for you to have a gun, not to have the gun taken away from you. All right? So it's fascinating how far we've gotten when even the people that are defending the right to keep and bear arms don't understand what it means. Now that takes me to one interesting point here. If you look at the powers of Congress, they gave certain powers to Congress essentially to create uniformity among the states. Congress has the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. Now think about those words. It has the power to provide for arming the militia. What do you think that would mean? If you don't get a gun, if a state doesn't give you the gun, Congress has got to get you the gun. It's to provide for arming, right? Not to provide for disarming. Think about how that plays into every gun control statute that you can think of, because they're all aimed not at arming, they're aimed at disarming. Gun control, under the correct principles of the militia, is having you with a gun in your hand, or in your house at least. Gun control we have today is to make sure that as many people as we can possibly disarm, we disarm. All right, the powers and duties of Congress, as I said, provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. Organizing simply means uniformity. They wanted to have a set of uniform regulations throughout whatever number of states we had. And it's interesting, too, to contrast that with Congress's powers with respect to the Army and Navy. Congress has the power to raise armies and to provide a Navy. We might not have an army. We might not have a Navy. Maybe Congress would decide we don't need them. They're not constitutionally indispensable or essential institutions. But Congress is supposed to organize this other thing that already exists. The militia is the only structure of that kind that has constitutional permanence. Creation is never involved with respect to the militia. It's only involved with respect to the Army and the Navy. As I said, the militia of the several states are, of course, state institutions. Congress has no power to create or to control any state institution. They can't create a state governmental body, right? I think the 10th Amendment says something about that. And Congress would have no authority at all with respect to the militia if it were not for that power to organize. That had to be given to them, or they wouldn't have had that power because these are state organizations. And if we look to the power of Congress to what's called provide for calling forth the militia, just stop right there. Calling forth from where? Right? If these were federal institutions, there'd be no need to call them forth from somewhere. They'd be part of the federal structure. Right? Well, it's, of course, to call them forth from where they're supposed to be, which is within each of the states. To call them forth for what purposes? Well, only three. Execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So it's a very limited authority that Congress has even there. And this, of course, is the reason the National Guard was created in 1903. Because there had been a determination by the Attorney General a few years earlier that the militia could not be called up to serve in foreign wars. And people in 1903 were thinking about foreign wars. In fact, one came up quite soon thereafter, 1914, 1916, and we got into it. Right? They were already thinking about this. And they had to create some other entity. And that's why the National Guard was created. And of course, people will tell you today the National Guard is part or is the militia, and of course that is completely erroneous. But that's the folklore, that's the propaganda, trying to get around that constitutional limitation on Congress. And it's interesting that you tie that in with the president's power. The president is, of course, the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states, and the same are called into the actual service of the United States. So the end of tells you these are separate entities. There's the Army and the Navy over here. There's a militia over here. And he becomes commander-in-chief when? Is he commander-in-chief now? Well, no, they haven't been called into the actual service of the United States. So it's an extremely limited power that he has. This is not the Bush theory of presidential power. This is the Founding Fathers theory, quite a bit different. And the Bush theory, I think, is the leader principle, or as in the language most appropriate for expressing it, das Führerprinzip. The Founding Fathers had quite a different idea as to the way this was going to be structured. But it's fascinating there to look at the word actual. President of the United States is commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. They were that worried that they put that word actual in there. Don't give me some propaganda reason. I want the actual service. And the actual service is those three purposes. And given that the militia are state institutions, if the president of the United States, pursuant to some congressional statute that's unconstitutional, calls forth the militia being controlled by state officers, can say, well, wait a minute, this isn't the actual service of the United States. This is some adventure of your own. We're not coming. That's the check and balance. That word right there is the essence of the check and balance. And it's the only time it appears in the Constitution. The actual service of the United States. How worried they were, concerned that they were. Well, I've already given you the disabilities, or some of the disabilities, lack of power that Congress has, and contrasted the militia with the Army and the Navy. There can't be a national militia. Militia of the several states. There can't be a militia of the United States. You know what the militia statute that Congress passed says? Title 10 of the United States Code, Section 311. It talks about the militia of the United States. These guys can't even get it right. They can't even get the title right. All right? The militia statute talks about the militia of the United States. The Constitution talks about the militia of the several states. Obviously, we have some cognitive dissonance there. Right. And also, if you notice, another thing about Congress's powers, they are all powers to provide for. That's the language, to provide for organizing, arming, disciplining, to provide for governing, so forth and so on. Not to provide against, not to fail to provide at all. And if you look at the actual structure of the militia in this country in terms of congressional statutes, essentially nothing there. The statute that I'm talking about defines the militia of the United States, and I don't even know what that is. I don't think they do either, as having two components, basically the National Guard, naval militia, and then everything else is the unorganized militia. What's the power of Congress in that respect? It's to provide for organizing the militia. If the power is to provide for organizing the militia, how can you have an unorganized militia? This is Dick and Jane constitutional reasoning, all right? This is not something that you have to go to Harvard Law School to understand. Okay. Give you another example. Gun control. One big segment of the gun control laws that come out of Congress are based on the power to tax. I don't know how many people here are interested in machine guns, sort of shotguns. There may be some. They're legal. I shouldn't say this. This is not Dillinger we're talking about here. But in order to transfer one of those, you have to pay, I think it's still $200. It's $200 transfer tax, maybe $250, whatever. It was a lot of money in 1934 when they passed the statute. There's this transfer tax. All right, so it's a tax on the possession of a firearm that I would say is particularly useful or would be particularly useful for militia service. Look at the power to tax in the Constitution. Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes to provide for what? The common defense and the general welfare. So if Congress has a power to provide for the common defense and Congress has a power to provide for arming the militia, how can Congress exercise a tax that in essence disarms members of the militia? Interesting disjunction there. You think about the power to regulate commerce. That's the other big power that's used as the basis for gun control. Gun Control Act of 1968, the one that set up all these federal licensees in the gun stores, the one that prevents certain people from buying certain kinds of arms. I can't come from Virginia into Maryland and buy a handgun. 1968 statute. All right. If I give that handgun to a child under 18 years old, even at a shooting range, and the child does not have in his possession a signed Youth Handgun Safety Act form from me, that's a crime. Commerce Clause. Right. Well, the militia are not commerce. They're parts of the state government. The militia are not among the several states because each militia is part of a particular state. So how is it that Congress is able to regulate the militia under the Commerce Clause? And as I pointed out, every one of these statutory structures that were in existence in the colonial period all presupposed a free market in firearms. That is, the actual commerce in firearms in those days was part of the whole militia structure because the militia depended upon this commerce to arm itself. How then is Congress regulating that in a negative way? If they were exercising the commerce power consistently with their militia power, they would be doing everything to free up commerce, not to limit it and control it. Now let's take the commander-in-chief. We've heard a lot about the commander-in-chief. The one thing I know is the fellow that we have in there down has no conception whatsoever of what the commander-in-chief powers are. And I shouldn't blame that on him because he's got a lot of advisors that are telling him this, obviously, right? Those people behind him. All right. The power is very simply stated. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. And again, I focus on that word, actual service. They had to be actually performing that function in fact and in law, or he is not exercising his power as commander-in-chief. All right. You have to have that set of factual and legal contexts. Otherwise, the designation, the status, doesn't obtain. Now, you hear a lot today from certain people in Washington about the inherent powers of the executive, the inherent powers of the commander-in-chief. Well, we know from the very fact that power is delegated and granted in the Constitution, that it is not an inherent power of the executive. Otherwise, it wouldn't have had to be stated. All right? If the executive power, which is how that Article 2 begins, the executive power shall be vested in the president, if that included the power of the commander-in-chief as an inherent power, then there would have been no need for this other provision that makes him commander-in-chief. All right? Well, why did they do that? Because if they hadn't put that in, he would not have been commander-in-chief. Congress could have determined who was commander-in-chief. And how do I know that? Let me go back to the pre-constitutional English law. Because remember, this country, the colonies, were under British imperial law before the Declaration of Independence. And under British imperial law, the king, not the parliament, but the king, who was the English executive officer, the king enjoyed, and here I'm going to quote from Blackstone, the sole prerogative of making war and peace. He acted as the generalissimo, or the first in military command within the kingdom. He exercised the sole power of raising and regulating fleets and armies, and the sole supreme government and command of the militia. In other words, this one man could cause Britain to go to war, and then he had command of all of the forces on land and sea. What you notice about the Constitution is, other than the office of commander-in-chief, every one of those powers is not given to the president, but is given to Congress. It's the exact inversion of the British system. All right? And because it's given to Congress, it is denied to the president. If Congress has it, it's a legislative power, and it isn't an executive power anymore. And that's the reason that they had to state it. Because if they hadn't stated it, if they hadn't delegated those explicit powers, they would have been treated as executive powers under the long-standing British law tradition. Fascinating, isn't it, how this works? And once again, I say, this is Dick and Jane. If you put yourself back in the position of the framers, if you've read the first volume of Blackstone, where he lays out the structure of the British government and British law, and then you look at what they actually did in the Constitution, you'll see exactly why they did it and what the consequence of this is. So they denied the president the power to make war and peace. Congress has the power to declare war, and by hypothesis, the power to undeclare war after war is declared. So for someone in the executive branch there in D.C. telling us that once something has gone on and they've sent troops to wherever they've sent troops, Congress can't force those troops to come back. I don't know what he's been smoking. All right. The king's power of raising and supporting fleets and armies became the congressional power to raise armies and to provide for a navy and to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. Now think about that one for a second. If I'm the commander-in-chief, whatever that is, and Congress has the power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, do I have to follow those rules and regulations of the land and naval forces? Of course I do. Because if I don't, every other member of the land and naval forces will have to follow those. I won't have any command. So this concept that the commander-in-chief is somehow separate and independent of congressional statutes controlling the army and the navy is nonsense on the face of it. Thirdly, the king's supreme government of the militia, who has that power now, at least at the federal level, Congress, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, etc., to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. If Congress doesn't pass a statute, the president has no authority. The states have the authority. It's fascinating how little authority the president actually has under the Constitution of the United States. How little real authority he has and how much real authority Congress has. Right? So the president is commander-in-chief, but he's always subject to the powers of Congress to make these rules and regulations. And in fact, if Congress doesn't give us an army and navy, he commands nothing. All right? He's commander-in-chief of the militia, but Congress controls any organizing, arming, and so forth and so on. And the states appoint all the other officers, which certainly limits the ability of the president to step too far out of constitutional line. And he is commander-in-chief of nothing else. Think about that. He's not commander-in-chief of the United States. He's commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states, we call them the actual service of the United States. He is not a duce. He is not a Führer. He is not even a decider. He is none of those things in the Constitution of the United States. Okay, in this other creature that we have wandering around in D.C., it may be a different matter. All right. And on top of all of this, the president has a constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That's probably the most important part of his whole Article II authority. It's a duty. It's a power, too, but it's a duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And I would assume that that would include the highest law of the land, the Constitution, and the provisions dealing with his status as commander-in-chief. Right? I would assume that. Having read the Constitution, I would assume that. Now, why did the Founding Fathers engage in this rather radical departure from British law? They had nothing better to do? Yes. Why not? Okay, no. Now, we can't presume that there's any clause in the Constitution that was intended to be without some specific effect. And it was because they wanted to be sure that the determination for or against war, the use of military forces, the calling up of the militia especially, because that's the ultimate military force, would remain in the hands of, if we're talking about Congress, a relatively large and diverse body of people, who would tend to serve as checks and balances on each other. If we're talking about the use of the militia, it's the states versus the general government. But whichever, the power would never gravitate into the hands of a single individual who could prove to be an incompetent or psychologically unbalanced. That's the last thing you wanted. You did not want the kind of kings they had seen in the history of England controlling all of this power. And remember, they had dealt with one in particular quite recently. What was his name? George III. Okay, it was another George, one of these Georges, all right? And so without this explicit designation of the president as commander-in-chief in the Constitution, who would designate the commander-in-chief? It would be the body that makes rules and regulations for the Army and Navy of the United States, right? Who is that? Congress. Congress could designate me commander-in-chief, not that I'd want it. The president would not have any claim on that authority if it hadn't been retained for him in the Constitution. Sometimes I think maybe that was a mistake that they made looking at what's happened. All right? So what that comes down to is the commander-in-chief's position is very limited. Congress is really the decider, if you will, at the national level. And with respect to the states are the deciders at the state level because if their officers refuse to march, they don't go. It's as simple as that. Now, I've already mentioned the role of the militia versus the regular armed forces, the armed forces being contingent. What you really need to do here, it's probably available to most of you, Story's commentaries. Joseph Story, he was one of the most famous justices of the Supreme Court. He sat in the court with John Marshall in that era. And in the early 1800s, 1833, I think the first edition of his commentaries on the Constitution came out. And you have to read that with a grain of salt, or maybe a teaspoon of salt, because he was a Federalist. He was very much of the John Marshall school. But he wrote the book in the correct manner instead of so much talking about what the court had ruled, because you can never tell whether the court decision is right or wrong. You have to compare it to the Constitution, right? It isn't the court decision that tells me what the Constitution means. It's the Constitution that tells me whether the court decision is right or wrong. Ah, oh yes. And so he wrote a treatise on the Constitution. He goes through section by section by section, and he analyzes it historically and legally and so forth. So he has an interesting section on the Second Amendment. And the point that he makes on the Second Amendment is that the ultimate purpose of the militia is the check and balance purpose against the standing army. It may be useful in terms of suppressing insurrections, enforcing the laws. It may be useful in terms of dealing with invasions, repelling invasions, as the Constitution says. But the ultimate unstated reason is to be the check and balance against the standing army that would serve the usurper or the tyrant. Okay? And that's clear, really, from the way the Constitution is set up. There are separate provisions for the militia, separate provisions for the army and the navy. These two things are never to come together. And that's why we see today the problem with the National Guard. I have nothing to say against the National Guard. It's a fine institution. But the idea that the National Guard is the militia is a frightening idea to me, because what that means is that the militia is actually part of the standing army. Seems to be a constitutional contradiction there. So you should take a look at Story's comment in his treatise. Now, this brings me to the final point, and actually what's the subject of this book. This is kind of a how-to book more than anything else. The book that I'm now working on goes into what I've talked about today, tonight, in great detail, overwhelming detail. And I just take two states. There was so much I couldn't do. I mean, I've done all the colonies, and I picked two, Rhode Island and Virginia. Rhode Island, it's a northern state. Virginia was a southern and a slave state. And they're both exactly the same. Rhode Island, you know the history of the Gatsby affair? Rhode Island actually had the first incendiary tax protest pre-war of independence. Rhode Island was the most anarchic of all of the colonies. Let's call them independent, all right? Most independent thinking people in the colonies. It was known for the badness of its paper money. Its paper money was execrated throughout the colonies. It was a haven for smugglers, Narragansett Bay being an example. And a lot of New England merchants made their money through smuggling in Rhode Island. And the British were not too keen on that, and so they had revenue cutters that sailed up and down Narragansett Bay trying to, tax compliance. They had a tax compliance system. And one of these revenue cutters was the Gatsby. And the Gatsby had a particularly obnoxious captain. He would stop essentially any boat or ship that he saw plying the waters between Providence and Newport in Narragansett Bay and just board them and search them. Very high-handed individual. And the leading merchants of Providence, including John Brown, who was the second or the third wealthiest man in New England, organized a little cabal at the tavern where the merchants hung out, and they sent some boys through the streets, drummers, to bring together a group of patriots or pirates, depending on which perspective you might have. They muffled the oars of their whaleboats. They rowed down past Warwick to Nanquit Point. They boarded the Gatsby in a firefight, shot Duddington, captured the crew, put them all ashore, and burned the ship to the waterline. The king was sore distressed. And he set up a commission, and this was a commission of loyalists, interestingly enough. All the members of the commission turned out to be loyalists when the war finally broke out. So we can't assume that this was a bunch of people that were fudging their duties. And he offered huge rewards and immunity for everyone but the leading personalities in this affair. Because it was not only piracy, clearly boarding a ship, it was treason because it was an English naval vessel. And although probably everyone in Rhode Island knew within a week or two who had been responsible for this, nobody talked. They couldn't find a single witness. Now, what was interesting about the whole proceeding was that the king put the ultimate authority over whomever this commission exposed as being part of the piracy and treason in the hands of Admiral Montague. His flag was in Boston, along with General Gage. Remember him, General Gage? And Admiral Montague was supposed to take charge of these prisoners and do what with them? Sail them to England for trial. What was the penalty for treason at that time? Drawing and quartering. If you were lucky, you were hung. Drawing and quartering. They were going to go to England for trial, and in England, of course, they would have been convicted right handily. Now, the law of that time was that any crime committed in the colonies had to be tried in the colony where it was committed by, of course, a jury drawn from residents of the freemen of the colony. So this was something of a departure from the rights of Englishmen that the colonials understood. And the word was sent to Virginia. All the other colonies as well, the post riders brought it down to Virginia, that this was part of the scheme that the king, evil king, and Admiral Montague had worked out. And it became a cause celebre, this idea that you could be dragged away from your own residence and tried before, what, a military commission, perhaps, in England, or Guantanamo, wherever they would send them. All right, I mean, there are parallels. History has these parallels. They're fascinating to view. And there was a meeting of the House of Burgesses in Virginia, Williamsburg, Virginia, and some people that we might remember. Who was this one right here? Well, Patrick Henry was there. George Mason was there. Thomas Jefferson was there. And that was the beginning of the committees of correspondence. They looked at this event and said, this event is so dangerous that we now have to correspond among the colonies and make sure that we know of other instances of this kind and other usurpations that may come thereafter. And as we know, the committees of correspondence were really the internet of the day. that cemented the whole War of Independence sentiment. Right? And it came out of the burning of the Gaspee. If you go to Rhode Island today, I used to live in Rhode Island. I still live in Rhode Island. Nobody ever leaves Rhode Island. In your blood, right? It's like malaria. You can never get rid of it. You go now to what they call Gaspee Point. They have had the good taste to rename it. But there is not a monument. There is not even a stone there to memorialize this event. A bunch of little houses around, because it's on the water near Warwick, Rhode Island. Little houses around, and you go there and there's just a sand spit. They haven't put up anything. Fascinating. This may have been the event that really triggered the whole War of Independence, perhaps even more than Lexington and Concord. Lexington and Concord was the final straw, as it will. May have been the Gaspee event. Well, now I come to the political reconsideration. What we see today in homeland security in this country, and I hate those words because, you know, they're the words of the other side, in a sense. But we have to, it takes a crooked stick to beat a mad dog. We use what they give us. Right? They are thinking in terms of top-down organization. Why? Well, you could say it's because they're fascists and Mensheviks and Bolsheviks and all those bad things. I think it's just because they're bureaucrats. That's the way bureaucrats think. Right? They're given some detail to perform, and they think immediately in terms of control from the top down, pyramidal structures, and all the rest of that nonsense. Big regulations and the Federal Register, you know, the whole routine. That is not the way the Constitution organizes Homeland Security. It organizes Homeland Security from the bottom up. It's the militia that are necessary. The militia are state institutions, and they are made up of the total able-bodied population. Oh, and by the way, if you became 60 years old, that didn't mean that you couldn't volunteer for the militia. It simply meant that you weren't compelled to perform these functions. All right. So anyone who was, I don't know how many people were able-bodied after 60, but if you were able-bodied, you could perform these functions as well. Top-down versus bottom-up organizing. So what I have proposed in this book is a way of returning to bottom-up organizing. In one state's enough. Got to get it going somewhere, as an example. I would doubt it would be Rhode Island. I can imagine it might be a place like New Hampshire might, conceivable. I know enough people up there to think they might be able to do it. It might happen in Virginia, given Virginia's close proximity to Washington, D.C. I can imagine we have a fairly good House of Representatives there in Virginia. It might happen in a place like Wyoming. Who knows? I'd rather have it happen in one of the original 13 colonies, because then you can draw directly from all of this history, and there's no question about it. So that's what I propose in this book, sort of a how-to manual. But the point I want to make tonight is a more general one. If you think about these institutions, they were self-defense institutions. They were crisis organization institutions. But fundamentally, they were political institutions for self-government, because they avoided and they suppressed the leader principle. You didn't have the leader principle in the militia. You had the popular principle. Why? Because everyone was a part of this. And everyone recognized what his duty and his legal authority was. And the point I'd like to make about the absence of the militia, under the circumstances in which we find ourselves today, it's obvious that free and fair elections, if we have them, aren't enough. I say if we have them. We have all sorts of problems with whether these elections are free or fair, or whether the votes are even counted. But assuming that we had them, they still wouldn't be enough under the present political psychology that's dominating this country. Because what goes on between the elections is vitally important. And so you may have a period of 2 years or 4 years or 6 years of essential political madness before you get another opportunity to vote. So there had to be a mechanism. There has to be a mechanism for dealing with this period in between, when you suddenly discover that some rogue public official that's gotten himself elected through lies and false promises. Right? And especially when the checks and balances system within the governmental apparatus, the regular checks and balances system, begins to break down. I went to a conference just the other day, privacy conference, people concerned with violations of privacy in many different areas. And they had a group of people who were the privacy enforcement officers that were connected with various divisions of Homeland Security. And what they are there to do is to protect our privacy from what Homeland Security may be doing in terms of investigation and so forth and so on. Oh, how cynical you are. And the point that every one of them made was that they are really concerned about their constitutional duty. They take their oath of office seriously. And we should believe this. Well, I tried to be charitable. I didn't want to ask the obvious question. When in the last 50 years has any official of the federal government ever been prosecuted for violating his oath of office?
Amen.
Name him. Her. Or it. I can't think of one. I can't think of a single one that has ever been prosecuted for violating his oath of office.
Amen.
And yet, what is the oath of office? To support the Constitution. To be bound by this oath. What does the word bound mean, you think? They don't just take the oath. They take it and will be bound by it. I would guess that means I'm subject to some kind of punishment if I don't do this. And yet, I can't think of one in the last 50. For that matter, I can't think of one in the last 100 years. Well, actually, no, because there was Otto Kerner, the federal judge that was caught for corruption. And he was impeached and removed. But he wasn't prosecuted, as I recall. Or he had a deal made. He wasn't prosecuted. So when these checks and balances break down, not only is something happening now, but it may have an effect on the next election. And you can imagine it spilling over into election after election after election. And the whole system rots from the inside out. There has to be some institutional mechanism capable at all times of educating people as to what's going on, of organizing and mobilizing them to some kind of action, and it has to have legal authority. This can't be done by people forming private groups or petitioning on their own. And finally, it has to have a real ability to deter or if necessary, to resist the kind of oppression that's discovered operating in the government, whether that government is in Washington, D.C., or in scenic Annapolis, Maryland, or in Richmond, Virginia, wherever it may occur. And the only institution of that kind, interestingly enough, for which the Constitution provides is the militia. These are permanent establishments within the government of the states and of the general government, if they're called into the service of the general government. They have authority that can be exercised at all times, not just as elections, not just at elections. The authority is exercised by whom? The members. Who are the members? We the people, in the most fundamental sense. So these are the ultimate protectors of popular self-government, which leads me to conclude that we ought to have them, and which explains to me why we don't.
Yeah, amen.
All right? Explains to me why we don't. You can imagine if you had this kind of a structure, they'd be meeting on a regular basis. They'd be discussing all the various homeland security issues, whatever those might be as they came up, local, state, or national. They'd have legal authority to do something about that. And the thing that fascinates me, too, is most of these homeland security problems are relatively local problems. They're things that are going to happen where we are. They're not going to happen on the dark side of the moon, right? It may be that we need intelligence being collected by the Department of Defense or, God forbid, the CIA or what have you, that have NSA, that have access to these other sources. But the events themselves are going to happen here, because if they happen over in England or over in France, I really don't care too much about that. That's their problem, right? And if you think about this from the point of view of intelligence gathering, what I like to call the problem of rational economic calculation, it's impossible to make up a plan without information about the problem. And many times the information on the problem develops only in the course of your working on the problem there at that level. And this is the reason that the Soviet Union failed with its planned economy, because the bureaucrats were trying to guess what should be done here instead of being there to act on the information. And if they had been there acting on the information, they would have had a free market, not a planned market, so it was a vicious circle for them. And the same is true here. Which leads me to conclude this thing that they're setting up in Washington will be a failure simply because it is impossible for them in the long run to get all the information that they would actually need to protect us. Which leads me to conclude that perhaps they're interested in protecting something else, but I leave that aside. That's their own problem, all right? Now, my problem is that this is all obvious. I really don't think you need to have gone to Harvard Law School to understand this. You simply need to have read the Constitution, and in my case, go back and do a little bit of work looking at those statutes. And as I said, there was a Selective Service book out there where You know, in a week you can read them all. They're all the same. You see what it is. Our problem is that the population of this country either doesn't know, or perhaps worse, doesn't care. I think it's the doesn't care. Because if you present this information to them, they shrug their shoulders and say, well, so what? It doesn't make any difference to me. All right. Now, let me just give you one example of how vital this may be. This is not what I would call theoretical. We have a problem with the banking system. I love talking about the banking system. And it's inherently flawed. Fractional reserve central banking is a disaster waiting to happen. And we now see it beginning to unravel. And I don't expect that it's going to collapse tomorrow because there are a lot of tricks that they can pull to keep the bubble from imploding. And probably we will go through a number of cycles such as the South American countries went through with relatively massive inflation. They'll try to change some currency. And they may even try to change it to an international currency, the Amero scheme, if you've read about that. You may have an idea what that's all about. But let me tie the militia concept into the Federal Reserve problem. You will not solve the Federal Reserve problem directly. You can't repeal the Federal Reserve and expect not to have a catastrophe because the markets are operating on the basis of Federal Reserve note values. All the prices are expressed. They don't call them, they call them dollars, these prices, but they're really talking about the currency of this banking cartel. All right? So you can't just rip that out tomorrow and not have the whole superstructure of the economy drop down on your head. The only way, it seems to me, to do it is to bring the forces of the free market into play by setting up a competing currency system. Gold and silver, the constitutional system over here, and this other thing, this paper thing over here. And to make this one work, we require the national government gradually, because it has to take a little bit of time, within 6 months to a year, to take all of its finances off the paper system and put all of its finances on the gold system. And actually, I drew up a bill for doing this for the state of New Hampshire. And it kicked around for a long time because some people in the key committee didn't like the idea of anything like this. It was to put New Hampshire on a gradual process. And once you have the government on this gold and silver system, you have the pump process because the government is bringing in money in taxes, and that will have to be paid in gold and silver. People have to get that from somewhere. The government is paying out to its creditors. It will be doing that in gold and silver, and therefore people will have that to spend. And pretty soon you will see people not simply dealing with the government in gold and silver, but dealing with each other in gold and silver because it will be much more convenient. And then what you will see, once money becomes gold and silver in this country, and now you will have gold and silver being loaned at interest so people can make profit from it, which you can't by keeping it in a box under your bed, you will see all the gold and silver of the entire world flow into this country. Wow. Because this will be the only country in the world with a sound and constitutional monetary system. Amen. And all of that gold and silver, which is earning nothing wherever it is, will come in here to earn something. And then, of course, the banks will have to compete with this, and they'll be forced to go back on a redemption standard if they can do it, or go out of business. And new banks will come up to begin with on a redemption standard. And the whole thing will change, and it will be what you call the reversal of Gresham's law. And if you say this can't happen, it did happen. It actually happened in the Soviet Union under Lenin. It was one of his tricks. It was called the Chernovitz. He put in this new currency and propped up the economy for political reasons. He had a reversal of Gresham's law, so it can happen. Now, how does this tie into the militia? Well, it's very simple. You could do this through a militia structure because, of course, this is an aspect of the Homeland Security problem, so as one of the duties of the militia, every member of the militia has to obtain a certain amount of gold and silver percentage of his income and keep this somewhere. They have to work out means within their own localities for using this as an actual medium of exchange. The whole militia structure functioned on fines. If people didn't perform their duty, if they didn't show up with a gun, didn't have their ammunition at home, whatever it was, there was a schedule of fines they had to pay. They'd all be paid in gold and silver. You'd run this whole operation on gold and silver. Now, what are we talking about? 1,000 people? We're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. You would turn the whole economy right side up overnight. And what's fascinating to me is this could be, if you had a Ron Paul presidency or someone of that kind who understood his responsibilities here, this could be done by revitalizing the militia in one or more states, one after the other, And it would have its own impetus, its own momentum to it. It would essentially be unstoppable. There's nothing the banks could do to stop it because they have no authority over the militia. That's what's fascinating about it. They have no authority over the militia. And if Congress were to attempt to intervene in some way and pass some restrictionist law, the presidential veto would come down. And if Congress passed that restrictionist law over the presidential veto, the president would be right to say, well, this is unconstitutional. I'm not going to listen to that. We're going to continue what we're doing. And once you saw the economic effects of this, the great mass of people would go entirely along with it. The whole system could be reversed from the bottom up. And that's why I say these folks in the banking system are riding a tiger. You know the old nursery rhyme? The lady from Niger rode on the back of a tiger, and when she came back from the ride, how'd this go? The smile was on the face of the tiger, right? They can't afford to get off. But on the other hand, they know that it's coming down. They're caught. They're essentially boxed in. So it's fascinating to me after looking at, studying these two things, the monetary system and the militia. I studied the monetary system for years and years and years. And the great problem with that is it's almost impossible for the average person to understand. They think it's too complicated. And to a certain extent, it is complicated. Not really that complicated. Now is the first time in all the time I've been studying this from the late 1960s to now, we are beginning to see the big breakdown occurring in such a way that people cannot disregard it anymore. And we will see more of these events. The mortgage meltdown is just the first major one. And if that can be combined with a desire on the part of people to reorganize this society constitutionally from the bottom up, this would be the lever that would enable us to actually turn the whole thing upside down. So we're living, I think, in I like to look at it as very optimistic times. Provided that what our host here is doing can be spread to a sufficient number of people. That, what is the expression in atomic bomb physics? The critical mass, right? You only need just enough to set the whole thing off. And I think that's what we're seeing in this country. The possibility of that critical mass developing because of circumstances, because of the way the political debate is going in this particular presidential election, because of much of what has been done in the past two terms of this administration, and people are finally beginning to wake up to the significance of that and the danger of it. All of those things, to use the word, conspiring together simultaneously. So I leave that with you. I'm optimistic, at least. This is the first time in the many years that I've spent studying this subject that it looks as if something could practically be done, or done practically, if you will. And I think it's just a matter of whether or not the American people still have it in them to live in the kind of a country that the Constitution provides. Up to us, as the Constitution says, three most important words are, we the people. Thank you. I'll entertain any questions of anyone who has them.
How did you ever recover from your Harvard education?
It wasn't a matter of recovery. See, when I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, I studied chemistry. And then I went to the graduate school and I studied chemistry. And chemistry is not a political doctrine. There is reality, and then there are the things that don't work. Right? And you can't mumbo-jumbo your way through this the way lawyers do. By changing definitions of words in the middle of the experiment and expecting things to change. And so when I went over to the law school, because after I finished in the graduate school of chemistry, I went over to the law school, I looked at it and said, this is a joke. This has no scientific validity. I mean, they're making this stuff up as they go along. And I said, and that led me to begin to think, why are they making it up? And what is the reality there, if there is any reality? Is it all false, or is there some reality? Well, when you start digging for the reality, it's there. And the rest of it you see is, you know, essentially propaganda and special interest pushing this or that. So I really didn't have to recover from anything because I never caught the disease.
Perfect. And you perfectly really led into my real first question. I can't believe how you did that, because I started to circle where you used a term early on. You said it was a fascinating distinction. And you were referring to this idea that the right to keep and bear arms is really a duty to keep and bear arms. And then you developed that in your talk. And then many of the points that you made had to do with the definition of words. He had to do with the definition of free and definition of state. I started circling what calling forth means, what actual means, mm-hmm. what the word actual means. You talked about the distinction between the National Guard is not a militia, so I circled those two words. It's important to know what the words mean. Troops, what troops mean, what a standing army is, et cetera, et cetera. How important is it if you want to tyrannize and to control, centrally control, how important is it to be the one or the group of, the small group that says what the words mean?
Well, it's vital. And it's vital to be able to say what is means, right? We've already heard that one. We know that one. All right? And that brings me back to the Supreme Court, a comment I made earlier about the Supreme Court. This is their métier. This is their...
métier.
Yeah, their trick, all right, as it were. This is their trick. This is the real skill that they have, is to take a constitutional term and say, well, here we have this, and what this means is this, and what this means is, and what that means is this, and what this means is that, and pretty soon you're way over here in terms of meaning, because we're talking about connotations as opposed to denotations. I love to play that game between connotations and denotations. This is the denotation, the word in the Constitution. We have all these connotations. We suddenly come over here. And sometimes this is actually the opposite of what we started with. And they do that constantly. Why? Because they're stupid? No. Because they don't like the result that they find here. And they want to give us a... We were talking about it earlier today.
Benefit.
The Kelo decision.
Right.
Constitution talks about no... private property shall be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, we got a couple of words in there that are interesting. The first one is just. Just. Just is a natural law term. Think about that for a second. It's in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, right? Just powers that governments have. People delegate just powers to the government, meaning you can't delegate unjust powers, meaning that this government has no unjust powers, all right? But where does the definition of that term come from? It comes from the law of nature and of nature's God, and that wasn't the law of gravity, by the way. It was natural law. And you know one thing, if you go to Harvard Law School, probably any big law school, the last thing they will ever let you talk about is natural law. And yet here's a natural law term right there in the Fifth Amendment. There's a natural law term in the preamble. Establish justice. Well, it's fascinating how those things just kind of crept in there somehow, right? But here's the Kelo decision. Public use. I understand public use. It's use by the public. Use by these governmental entities, the state, the locality, what it is. They change that, and the Kelo decision say, well, what that really means is public benefit. Ooh, that's a completely different concept, right? That's open-ended. And the way that decision went, they could take your property and give it to me because I'm going to put something of a higher benefit in terms of tax payment. All right? Well, on that theory, of course, there's no such thing as public property anymore. It's gone. Private property is gone. Excuse me. Private property is gone. But that's their trick. And I have seen this for years and years and years, primarily because I represented a lot of people who were on the wrong side of the political line. And my experience was you can tell who's going to win a case by looking at the caption. And if one of those people in the caption has this little red X next to his name, he's on the wrong side of the political line, it don't matter what he says. He can have all of the precedents on his side, he can have all the logic on his side, he can have the bloody statutes on his side, and somehow or other he always ends up losing. If you're not a person that has a political axe to grind, the system works fairly nicely. Corporate law, right? I suppose you can get into some problems there, but generally speaking, it works pretty nice, and I've seen that too. But I had a peculiar practice. Every one of my clients was some kind of
had an X.
Yeah, he was one of these X people, all right? He was one of these X people. And then I learned all the different ways that they did this. And after a while, I said, this is ridiculous. Now, what am I doing here? I mean, I don't mind casting pearls before swine, but I have to have swine. I'm not going into some courtroom and have some judge tell me that the very statute that says X means minus X. What's the point? And so I said, well, now I have to become some kind of a propagandist. All right? I've got to go to the real judiciary in this country, the people.
When we start with this gold and silver standard, how do we distribute some of it to start with so that we have money in our pockets to pay the fines or whatever else is required?
Well, you're going to have a competitive system. And you're going to have a free market price of gold. You're going to have paper money still circulating, so they'll be exchanged back and forth there. And the market is going to set those prices. That's the first thing. I mean, if you're talking about cash in hand. But the second level, of course, is you start pricing your services or products in gold and silver. And what I imagine would happen at a certain time, you'd walk into the supermarket and there'd be two price structures. One would be the paper money price structure, whatever they call that, the F price structure. And then the other would be probably the silver price structure, because most things in a grocery store probably don't have enough value to be priced in gold. If you went into Mercedes-Benz, they'd have a very large number here in paper money, and they'd have a relatively small number here in gold. Mm. And the system would equilibrate. Slowly but surely, equilibrate, come to an equilibrium, okay. Because the market is the one that's going to change these prices and determine what the real values are. And see, that's the key to the whole thing about changing this system over. You cannot do it by bureaucratic management. You run into this economic calculation problem. The Treasury Department cannot tell us what the price of gold should be day after it is reused by the Treasury Department. Why? Because the day after it's reused by the Treasury Department, its value is going to go up some indeterminate amount because now it has a new use that didn't have before. Mm. Congress can't predict that. The Treasury can't predict that. Only the market can tell us what it is.
If I may, and I'm being presumptuous a little bit, did your question, I read into the question a little bit about, is there enough supply of gold and silver for that? Is that what you meant?
There is a misunderstanding with respect to this concept of supply of money, and it's been generated by the other side as a rationalization for their constant inflation of money. They want us to believe that prices shouldn't change relative to money. Money is an economic good. It doesn't have a fixed value. Its value fluctuates against all other economic goods. They want us to believe something different, so they'll have a reason for constantly increasing the supply. If you had a gold and silver standard, what you would see happening is what happened in the late 1800s. Prices would start to come down, relatively speaking. The purchasing power, the value of gold and silver would go up. And whom would this benefit, by the way? This would benefit wage earners. Because most of the wealth of a wage earner at any particular moment is what he's earning. And if what he's seeing is his wages are going up in purchasing power, his real wealth is going up in purchasing power. And that's why, at the turn of the century, if you read a newspaper called the American Federationist, which was the newspaper of the American Federation of Labor, the big labor union, legitimate labor union, because the Wobblies were there too, but they were more an anarchic group. There are articles in that period of time as to how important it is to the working man to have a sound money system based on gold and silver. Mm. And when you read them, they're fascinating because these people were not intellectuals. Most of them probably didn't even have a high school education, as we would understand it. They went to apprenticeship. That's usually how they learned their trades. They probably went to a grade school. They learned how to read and write. And they did learn how to read and write. And then they went off to apprenticeship to become skilled tradesmen of one kind or another. And you read the American Federation, read these articles. Your average college graduate couldn't understand what they're talking about. But they understood. And they understood the great danger of central banking. That, in fact, that was the bete noire that they had. The danger that they foresaw. They said, we don't want this because this is going to be in the hands of the big capitalists and financiers who are our opponents. And the thing that we want to protect ourselves is gold and silver in our pockets, in our hands. The same idea of Jackson. Andy Jackson, not Stonewall. Andy Jackson. Might have been Stonewall too, but it certainly was Andy Jackson. His concept was gold and silver in the hands of the working man, not paper. We don't want the gold and silver in the bank somewhere where the working man can get his hands on it. We want it in his own hands.
I came across this a couple years ago because I was reading the budget, and Congress gets about, or the legislative branch gets a couple billion dollars a year, and the judicial gets about the same. And the White House gets, at that point, got $27 billion for running the White House. But then I found out it was the State Department that was using a lot of this money to pay for mercenaries.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't know where he gets this authority. That's a lot of things they're doing in Washington. I don't know where they get this authority. They just claim it. And you know why they claim it? Because we let them claim it. everything that they're doing there that we could put on this board in 8-point type that's unconstitutional, fill this up, we're responsible for. Otherwise, this is not a self-governing country. You can have it one way, you can have it the other. It's not a self-governing country, I'm not responsible. It's a self-governing country, I am responsible. And self-government is not a spectator sport. You cannot sit there and watch football and drink beer and expect to be self-governing republic.
You mentioned the distinctions between the militia and the National Guard and the National Guard's origins in 1903. Can you expand on that a little bit? And then can you tell us how we get a check and balance against a national army now, since there's essentially no armed check and balance below the national level?
Well, starting from the back end of that question, the answer is we don't have any check and balance now. If you go to almost every state, it's structured along the lines of what they call the militia. They'll have some militia section. Virginia has one. It's called the military laws. Definition of militia. Militia is the National Guard, the Naval National Guard, which is a naval component of that. A thing they call the Virginia Defense Force, which is a component of the National Guard that comes into play when the National Guard's called out of the state. And then this other thing called the unorganized militia. If you go to a state like New York, there are a few of these. They have something in between which they call the State Guard. New York State Guard, I think Texas has one, Texas State Guard. And New York, I think, has 60,000 or so people who are organized. And that begins to look like a constitutional militia, except that it doesn't organize everybody, and their functions are extremely limited relative to the constitutional militia. So you don't have any place in this country that has a functioning constitutional militia, and most states have nothing even in that direction. The National Guard was set up because, as I said, people at the turn of the century, remember, you had the war against Spain, 1898. And this was the beginning of the great imperialistic adventure, which the United States is still participating. And one of the thoughts was, where are we going to get the cannon fodder for this? Remember, the war against Spain was fought with volunteers, Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Riders. They were volunteers and a very small professional army. An army that had spent most of its time fighting the Indians. So the question was, well, imperialistic adventures, we have to have hundreds of thousands, not tens of thousands. Where are we going to get them? And the Attorney General of the United States quite correctly said, well, you're not going to get them from the militia. They can't be sent overseas. They could volunteer. I mean, you could ask them to volunteer for this, but they cannot be conscripted for overseas service. They can be called up for only these three purposes, and none of the three is an overseas activity. Ah, so the wheels started turning in the heads of people in Congress, and they created this thing called the National Guard. And their cleverness was, the 1903, it's called the Dick Act, after Representative Dick, who wrote the thing. And the cleverness was, in that act, they repealed the 1792 Militia Act, which was still the basic militia act of the country. And they put this thing in its place. So if you just looked at that, you say, ah, this is now the new militia structure. And they wrote it that way for that purpose. Why? Because they had to have that propagandistic label on it. So that people would be willing to accept this. This wasn't some huge expansion of the army. Well, as I say, I have nothing against the National Guard in particular. You know, what they do is fine. But you have to recognize this is a part of the army. And so when they come out with their propaganda, and you'll see this in usually in April of each year, there's National Guard Day or whatever, it's April something or other. Say, April of something or other of 1631, the birthday of the National Guard. And they'll show pictures of these Massachusetts people in the kind of Puritan-type uniforms.
All in
that period, right? And they're there with their matchlock guns, and this is the beginning. Well, of course, it has nothing to do with the National Guard. Now, I understand why they're doing that. I think they're confused, and they're trying to play on this long historical continuity in which they're not a part. But I think when it originally came in, it was very subtly done for the purpose of essentially stealing the trademark.
I heard of a case just recently, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where the employer was paying his employees in silver dollars. So the employee would make maybe $5,000, and he was sued, and he won the court case that these were actual dollars, even though they're worth a lot more than 5,000 FRAUDs, Federal Reserve Accounting Unit dollars. But he was actually paying them in silver dollars, so employee would make maybe only $5,000 a year in silver dollars. And so the Internal Revenue took him to court, and tried to say, no, you're not paying them $5,000. You're really paying them a lot more than $5,000 because each one of these is worth, what, 8 to 1 or 10 to 1, whatever it is.
Multiple.
And such. And the employer said, no, no, no. These say a dollar on them. I'm paying them $5,000 because these each say a dollar. And they and apparently the employer won that case. Now, on the other hand...
Actually not. But really? There were two cases. The employer had some other tax problems.
Okay.
There were some people involved in the case who were the recipients of the gold or silver.
Yes.
At the face value, and they were reporting them or dealing with them at the face value. They were also indicted. This was a criminal case, by the way. They were indicted. They ended up with a hung jury, those people. So it may be that they would be retried. The employer was found not guilty. Now, what's interesting about that case is there was a Supreme Court decision. This goes to show you what I had said before about the courts. There was a Supreme Court decision in the 1870s, Thompson versus Butler. Thompson and Butler had a gold clause contract, which required Thompson to pay the value of the contract to Butler in gold coin. Why did he have that contract? Because there were these paper money units out there, the Lincoln greenbacks, which were depreciating, and he wrote that contract to get himself away from these paper units. It was a perfectly legal contract. And this was a simple contract case. Butler sues Thompson, and he wants the value of the breach of contract, he wants the value of the contract. He gets a judgment of $6,000-something dollars payable in gold. He then takes what's called a remittiture. A remittiture is where I, the winner, the judgment claimant, agree to reduce my judgment for some reason or other. Maybe because the judge isn't sure of his verdict. He says, I'm not going to let you have $10,000, but if you reduce it to $7,000, I'll let it stand. In this case, Thompson owed $6,100. That was the judgment. Butler agreed to take $5,000 even. Now, you'd ask yourself, well, why did Butler want to do that? The answer was, at the time, they had the statute that dealt with appeals to the Supreme Court of the United States required the amount in controversy to be more than $5,000. So by agreeing to have only $5,000, Butler cut off Thompson from his ability to appeal to the Supreme Court. Well, Thompson wasn't going to take that lying down. You know, no lawyer would let his client take that lying down. Thompson appealed anyway and said, wait a minute. He said the same thing that the IRS said in this case. He said, yes, Butler has received $5,000 in gold, but the reality is out there in the market that what's really circulating are the greenbacks. People don't circulate gold. They keep gold in their pockets. They pay with greenbacks. Greenbacks are the real money, and this $5,000 is really worth whatever, above $5,000, and therefore I am entitled to appeal. Okay. What does the Supreme Court say? Do they agree with the IRS subsequently? The IRS? No, they say exactly the opposite. They say Congress has set up a two-track monetary system. One is in gold and silver, and these things are called dollars, and the other is in this paper currency, and these things are valued in dollars. And we recognize that the economic value of the paper is much less in the marketplace than the economic value of the gold and silver. But it is for Congress to determine what the money is, not the economic value of the marketplace. Hmm. And we are only a court. We can't override the determination of Congress. And therefore, Mr. Butler is correct, and we don't have jurisdiction to hear this case. Now, what is fascinating to me is that particular case was the centerpiece of the defense of one of the, at least one of the people who was receiving this money, who was a law student at the time. And in fact, he had written a paper on this subject, and the fellow who had graded his paper, had been his advisor in the seminar or whatever, was a judge of the appeals, federal appeals court, and suggested to this boy, this student, that the paper was so good that he should have it published. And yet the judge in that case didn't follow the Supreme Court's opinion. The prosecutor in the IRS didn't follow the Supreme Court's opinion. And apparently the jury wasn't clever enough to figure out that it needed to follow the Supreme Court opinion. So there's an example where you have the Supreme Court opinion specifically saying, we, the Supreme Court of the United States, can't do what the IRS wants to do.
Wesley Snipes, the actor, was acquitted of the IRS charges against him.
Oh, good for him.
He was facing 16 years. The only thing that he was going to face is failure to file, not willful failure to file, but failure to file, which are misdemeanor charges, which there's three, which carry a maximum of 3 years.
So he was acquitted of all the felony
yes.
charges.
Yeah.
Well, the jury believed that he was operating in good faith. That's the way all those cases go. Man comes up and says, I didn't believe this or I believe that, whatever, in terms of the operation of the tax, so-called tax laws. And the jury either says, we believe you or we don't believe. But I'll tell you one thing about that. I call that the insanity defense in a sense. No, really, because you think of what has to happen here. First place, you have to get on the stand to explain your beliefs. That's usually the most dangerous thing that a criminal defendant ever does is walk within 5 feet of that stand because he's subject to cross-examination. Secondly, you have to convince this jury that you believe something that probably no one of them believes because they've sanitized that jury pool so that no so-called tax protesters get in there. And thirdly, you have to convince them that you believe something that the judge will tell them in the instructions is not true. Hmm. The judges always tell the jury, this fellow did have to pay taxes. We all have to, something along that. We all have to pay taxes. They give him some statute. So you're really coming up there and having the jury... telling the jury, you've got to believe that either I am so bright or I am so stupid that I could believe something that all the rest of you know, as you said before, is true, right?
It's true.
Which
right.
isn't true.
Well, right back to Josh Billings again.
Yeah, right back to Josh Billings. And let me have the final word. If anyone is interested in this book, these little things are right around the corner. And if you aren't interested in the book, find somebody is because I'm find somebody who is because I'm in the recruiting mode. Right, there are 250 million real Americans in this country. I don't need them all.
Listen, Dr. Vieira, thank you so much. Please.
Thank you, Mike.